Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about... Welcome, international podcast listeners, to what's going to be a marathon reading of 250 pages of something called Zombie Myths of Australian Military History. Now, just listen to the title, you may immediately switch off. However, zombie myths, as will be described, are things that a local culture believes, and it becomes to a state where it's impossible to get rid of them. And you may have a source of amusement at some of the myths that Australians believe and, in fact, are not true. However, and so there may be sort of a feeling of superiority that my culture is not like this, but having lived in other places, like in France, Germany, a bit of time in England, a lot of time in America and Canada, all these cultures are subject to various zombie myths, things that they believe are not necessarily true, but it's very difficult to dislodge them because they've become central to the way they construct their society. Now, in Australia, we've got a shortened history, and we've got a military history which we celebrate and reinforce with ceremonies and various things like this, various documentaries, readings, and stuff like that. But indeed, some of the actual basis behind there is not correct. We've actually made it up, or we believe the incorrect things. And this is a particularly well-structured book, which actually goes quite to the actual heart of the matter by declaring them zombie myths. And I'll read the... for the first thing, I'll read the introduction of this book. So this... it's a contribution by 10 editors. Sorry, 10 academics on both these areas. And basically, upon studying this, they enter a space where they find out that what we believe as central core articles of faith of Australian history are in fact fictions or constructs, and they're not necessarily true. And in doing so, they have alienated themselves. They've alienated themselves from Australian culture with knowledge. And occurs on many little instances. So this is 10 instances here, and the question is the strategy to convert our zombie culture back into a more knowledgeable, caring, nuanced culture. Now, this is a particularly Australian story, however, it's a generic story, so the actual context is Australia, so you'll hear a bit about Australian history, and you may be interested in another culture. But your interest should also be in the fact that this applies equally well, particularly Chinese and Japanese culture. As I've read into Japanese war history, there's the zombie myths which get embedded into a culture and people start doing crazy things. To quote Voltaire, and I don't mean this for any particular culture, that those who would have us believe absurdities are those who would have us commit atrocities. That is, that these myths are actually absurdities, and at the end of the day, this clash of myths is a clash of absurdities, which is a clash of war and things like this. Very interesting to listen to it. So I'm going to read. There are 10 quite distinguished people, and it's peer-reviewed, so it's a very high-quality stuff, unlike the low-quality stuff I've been reading from science magazines recently. And we'll start off. And so these are very well believed people. So the title of this introduction is called The Walking Undead of Australian Military History. A zombie is a monster of folklore made popular in a modern era largely thanks to the horror fiction and the success of George Romero's 1968 film Night of the Living Dead. In recent times, zombies have become a feature of not only computer games and manga comics, but even English literature. A reworked version of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, featuring a mysterious plague fallen upon the quiet English village of Meryton, turning the dead back to life, hit the bookstands in 2009. There are zombies that appears everywhere, and their numbers might be growing. So this is one of the things you want to connect to your modern audience and start to tell them, perhaps zombie, this is my commentary, not the author, zombie is a brilliant way of actually capturing the issue. And it's not just military history, there's Australian science culture, every area of culture, we have these zombies going about the place. Back to the author here, the actual real podcast. Archetypal zombies are, of course, corpses brought back to life, sustained by various and usually nefarious forces in a more or less cataleptic or automaton state. The concept has its roots in the Afro-Caribbean region of voodoo, most notably in Haiti, where the word was first used to describe someone deliberately kept in a trance-like state, often for the use as cheap labor. True zombies share a unique set of characteristics. They act on instinct. They lack vitality and freshness. Instead, they are rotten and usually display a number of outward signs of decay. Despite this, they are strong and surprisingly resilient. Zombies are almost impossible to kill, and can sustain damage far beyond that of a normal living human. Imbued with unnatural energy, no matter how many times they are knocked down, torn apart, or laid to rest, the zombie will rise again. There is no doubt that... zombies are dangerous. Numbers are on their side. Zombies move in a slow, shambling, but deliberate gait and attack in mobs and waves. They are not thinking beasts and lack both individuality and lucidity. You cannot converse with them because they are neither rational nor reasoning. When they appear, they are legion, and they keep on coming, a slow, moving, shuffling apocalypse. Zombies have also a nasty habit, through the touch or bite or passing whatever syndrome that causes their condition onto others, so the disease spreads. I think the 1968 rise of zombies was, this is not here, but I know someone who's done a thesis on zombies, and their thesis was that zombies was, a way of paraphrasing the rise of communism, strike fear. That's how it rose in the US. But back to the things. So this is a beautiful analogy. You know that this is, we're going to talk about intellectual myths, but these are people walking around with these myths in their head. While it's a reasonably safe bet the zombies do not walk the earth in a physical sense, it's equally certain that their figurative counterparts haunt the understanding of Australian military history. Like their corporal equivalents, such as zombie myths are empowered by misdirected and unquantifiable energies. In this country, such forces are perhaps derived from our pressing need to commemorate and venerate the deeds of past servicemen, conceptions of national identity wrapped in the imagery of war, and the all-encompassing social implications of our central national legends, the Anzac and the Digger. Thus fueled, our intellectual zombies cut a sort of slow, staggering, and all but unstoppable path across the existing historiography of Australian involvement in past conflict. They do not reflect the fruits of scholarly analysis or critical interpretation. Although perhaps based on kernels of truth, they are not, for the most part, interesting in any sort of rational accuracy or precision. At the same time, their considerable, if slow-witted, inertia has a momentum all of its own. The zombie myths of Australian military history have survived blows landed by academics and historians for decades in some cases. Each time, individual zombies might lurch, or stumble for a short time, but then they grow back with undiminished stature. This is not a harsh, harmless phenomenon. Zombie myths are hazardous to our intellectual health, as their real counterparts would no doubt be to our physical form. the persistent misunderstanding and misrepresentation that zombie myths of Australian military history represents skew a proper understanding and interpretation of this nation's military heritage. They warp and twist our perception of war. They shape our picture of ourselves in obscuring and inaccurate ways. Moreover, they tend to situate our attitudes to the past falsely, and therefore to support our reading of the present and expectations for the future. They are monsters of the mind. Isn't this a fantastic literature? Honestly, this is one of the best reads I've ever read in a long time. It's just great. This author's a genius. The author is Craig Stockings. This book is an attempt to select some of the most resilient of these zombie myths and to expose them to the light of genuine analytical scholarship. Reasoned arguments are the holy water through a thorough analysis of the sharpened stakes and critical rigor. The crucifix is grasped tightly by the historians and professional researchers authoring the chapters that follow. What a brilliant editor. It's remembering that, as durable as they have proven to be, zombie myths are still myths, and so, with careful, rational explanation, it is possible to separate them out from what many Australians accept as objective, immovable truths. At least, that is our hope. The zombies of Australian military history are, in fact, as old as European settlement. This book begins with Dr. John Connor's examination of the idea Aborigines did not resist the occupation of Australia by British and Australian-born British subjects. Too much time and words have been spent trying to prove that there was no frontier war in Australia, or, alternatively, the frontier violence was restricted to various massacres in which Aborigines played the role of passive victims. Both ideas support the myth under scrutiny. Both ideas are mistaken. Indigenous Australians did fight, sometimes in quite innovative ways, and with limited success at various times and places. I should read that, going back to original documents, I'm just flabbergasted as a former, or being involved in intelligence, just reading these past papers go, what the heck? I won't go into it, but just reading some of the past documents, it's just so obvious. And you'll get some documents in this book which completely lay waste to people's misconception. More zombies were spawned even as the Australian colonies became a nation. In 1902, during the Boer War, Harry Hubbard, Breaker Morat, poet, prodigal son, bushman and buccaneer, came to die at the hands of the British firing squad in Pretoria, after bravely telling its members to shoot straight, you bastards. He was sentenced by corrupt British brass hats, sensitive to German opinion, and looking for a scapegoat for the incompetence and illegal orders. The Breaker was an all-Australian hero, whose only crime was to follow orders, and for that he was sacrificed to the Empire. So the fable about a largely fictitious character goes. I like it. It's fictitious. It's all fictitious. Not only does Dr. Craig Wilcock use Chapter 2 to expose the real Breaker Morat and the true circumstances of his crimes, he also investigates why the myth surrounding the man has grown so strong. The idea of the Breaker has served a social function powerful enough to transcend the reality of his life. Isn't that beautiful literature? This person is a genius. You can see this is such a pleasure to read rather than the New Scientist stuff. But it's different. You've got a full paragraph. They're not strict formula people with a three-sentence paragraph with sort of vaguely linked ideas and quotations. This is much better to read. Not long after the conflict in South Africa had subsided, with the nation still in its infancy, a plague of zombies accompanied Australia's first large-scale experience of war from 1914 to 18. At Gallipoli in 1915, two important and enduring fables grew out of the August offensive, the largest and failed major Allied offensive action before the evacuation of the peninsula in December. Despite more than 90 years of reflection, blame for the futility of this push which included such famous actions as Lone Pine, is still too often misdirected or obscured by the dominant idea that the events had very nearly succeeded. In Chapter 3, Rhys Crawley, with a contextualized overview of the August offensive that focuses on aspects such as planning, command, logistics, and inter-service cooperation, however, offers quite a different perspective. Moving from the Mediterranean battlefield to the European one, in Chapter 4, Dr. Elizabeth Greenlay goes to examine the prevailing notion that it was the Australians who broke the Hindenburg Line in the Western Front, which led inexorably to the defeat of Germany. Sir John Mannish, commanding the Australian Corps in 1918, wrote to the Minister of Defence, George Pearce, claiming the Australians were the dominating factor in forcing the enemy out of the Hindenburg Line into a situation which is compelling him to sue for peace. Such claims and subsequent tradition of overplaying the significance of Australian successes in the Hindenburg Line lack context and substance. Well, I don't know. I think you might be going over here the actual, having actually looked at the actual battle lines, I don't know. It'll be interesting to read that. World War II revived the military history zombies of past and added a few more of its own. My view is that we do have these zombies, but we do have these brilliant military operations in the middle that no one knows about. And there's massacres of Australian troops at various... There's all this itemization. We've got a very, very sanitized view. In Chapter 5, Dr. Craig Stocking examines the surprising pervasive idea that the diggers of 1940s were, by virtue of being simply Australian, somehow naturally superior to their adversaries, that they were, thanks to an Anzac pedigree, natural soldiers. The purpose of this chapter is to debunk the misguided notion. Ethnicity is no explanation of battlefield outcome. The Australians in World War II were ordinary men. Their place of birth or nationality is no indication of their martial potential and capability. Their heirs of Anzacs were not born soldiers, they were made soldiers. However, I must admit there were Anzac commanders, the commanders of World War I, were the commanders, the soldiers of World War I were the commanders in World War II. Probably no single event in... So that's one thing. I'd be interested to know. I probably have a more... I do think there's zombies here, but there are more to say. There's more, actually, to analyse about. If you literally look what the good people did and bring that forward, that's important. Probably no single event in Australia's military history has inspired more controversy and passionate debate than the loss of the Australian Lender class light cruiser HMS Sydney 2 in November 1941. Okay, so just to give you an idea, this ship, this sort of Australian top naval ship, was knocked out by basically a speedboat with a Pack 88, sort of a little like patrol German boat. So the Germans had a little one of those anti-tank guns. Those Pack 88 guns, and we're up the coast of Western Australia. It sort of came up and did bit and blew it out of the water and sank it. And it was huge. I think we lost 600 people all down. And you know, there's a huge amount of things. Of interest is that there used to be, it was sunk, and so there used to be a flower called the HMS Sydney Self-Raising Flower. So you could buy this. It was like a bad joke. In the supermarkets, you could go along and, how you have your bags of flour. And, let's continue about this. In Chapter 6, Professor Peter Dennis shows for almost seven decades speculations concerning the fate of Sydney has refused to die, no matter how heavy the weight of evidence and how long the national explanation has been produced to explain the ship's demise. Now, interestingly, I think we have located the Sydney. It's at the bottom of the ocean. And it's interesting that technology development meant that we could go off and search for the missing Malaysian aircraft. Like a true zombie, a story that is essentially simply, although tragic, is taken on its life of its own. Ever more preposterous with each retelling. It is a story seeking sinister explanations with deep roots in conspiracy theories. It is also a story of deception and deceit, sometimes self-imposed, but inevitably leading to perpetuation of untruths and misguided and misleading assertions. Well, good God. Now, we're spending $500 million on our war memorial. $500 million to upgrade our war memorial. So it's interesting to see how this goes. Dr. Peter Stanley uses Chapter 7 to challenge one of our most powerful and pervasive modern misunderstandings about the war in the Pacific. So we missed the North Africa stuff, which is actually quite incisive. Now, more than 65 years on, a great many Australians, perhaps most, believe as a matter of historical fact that Japan had planned to invade Australia, and had only been deterred by Allied, mainly Australian, victories on the periphery of its conquests in the Coral Sea, Emerald Bay, and Coracoga Trail. They believe that invasion would have occurred had not the Japanese been defeated in these critical battles. Worse, some believe Japanese forces actually landed a number of points around the Australian coast. Okay, and there's people I know who believe that, who have uncovered what they think are remains of Japanese landings. Such ideas have accumulated in the notion of the Battle of Australia, fought in 1942. They are entirely spurious. The Japanese were not coming south, or rather as far south as Australia. A Japanese invasion did not occur, and was never going to occur. The so-called Battle of Australia never took place. Well, we would say that there was Japanese submarines in Sydney Harbour popping off, blowing up sheds and stuff like that. Central to the Battle of Australia myth were a series of engagements along the Kokoda Trail in New Guinea in 1942. This campaign established itself as a position second, perhaps, to Gallipoli in the honour roll of Australian military success, even though we were beaten there. Soon after these battles ended a flood of written works, which extends to the present, convinced that Australians that fighting along the Kokoda Trail saved Port Moresby from the Japanese occupation, and the Battle of Isurara in late August 42, in particular, was the Australian Thermopylae. Without its valiant's last-ditch stand, these Australian soldiers at last halted the relentless Japanese march south. Our very hearths and home laid open under threat. In truth, however, Dr. David Stevens explains in Chapter 8, the Japanese were not stopped on the trail at all. Rather, their New Guinea campaign was thwarted in the Coral Sea, the Kota Canal, and Midway. And even when the Japanese and Australian infantry crashed on the Owen Stanley ranges, the result had more to do with broken Japanese logistics chains than Australian battlefield success. Okay, so at a particular point, the Japanese had run out of ammunition, were throwing stones at the Australians. So they had a cliff, and they were just throwing stones off rather than wasting their ammunition. Moreover, Australia's most important task in August and September 42 was not to stop the Japanese advance along the Kokoda Rail. It was to control the sea lands that kept Australia's economy, political stability, and military strength afloat. More recently, the zombies in military history stalked Australian involvement in the Vietnam War. In Chapter 9, therefore, Professor Geoffrey Gray, good man, explains some of the persistent myths and fables about the Australians' involvement in the controversial war. It argues that most Australians do not understand why their nation became involved, have little accurate idea of what the soldiers did and why they were there, and continue to describe to a variety of mistaken beliefs about the effects of their service in that war. The overriding misconception is that Vietnam somehow represents a unique occurrence in Australian military history, while that stands aside from the wars in the rest of the 20th century. That is just plainly wrong. Okay, well, I've done a lot of training with Vietnam vets. It's sort of pretty live. Okay, even as the new millennium dawned, a new generation of Australian military fables flourished. Firstly, among them concerned our nearest neighbour to the north. Australia conducted two military interventions in East Timor during the 20th century. Both have been falsely reconstructed into myths that vary sharply with the historical record. The first, in December 41, is widely assumed to have been made in order to expel the Japanese forces from the territory. It was not. Australian and Dutch troops invaded the neutral Portuguese Timor, East Timor, during World War II. The second invention, that's the most explosive thing you could say in an RSL. It's like to any Australian, if you said Australia invaded another country in World War II, neutral, it would just be the most provocative, explosive thing. And I even reading that, I think, wow. In September 1999, has since been reconstructed as a remarkable example of Australian government exercising, quote, responsibility to protect the people of East Timor. In fact, quite to the contrary, the government worked assiduously to prevent international intervention in East Timor. I know this is just horrid. Let's read it more. Until the bitter end, and it eventually was a UN force came in. In Chapter 10, Dr. Clinton Ferdinand examines both interventions, quoting extensively from declassified and leaked internal documents. The words of the Australian policymakers speak for themselves. Okay, that is just astonishing. It is important to note, amidst all the talk of military zombie myths, that there are a range of real and imagined social factors that have encouraged their prevalence and resilience. Many of these are themselves tied to the powerful foundation story of Australian nationalism, the ANZAC. Yeah. Okay, so if I can say, I have got what you call the Rosetta Stone of Australian history. It's this painting, a construct painting, where the people constructing it would send it back to England, send copies back to England, and so eventually they produced a animated cartoon. It's not an animated cartoon, you have to construct it. And it's just beautiful to see it. So here, stopping what Australian and ANZAC means Australian and New Zealand something AC. I don't know, that's the group of Australians, the Empire Force, which fought for Britain in World War I. The ANZAC legend needs to commemorate and venerate the deeds of past servicemen to connect the very notion of being Australian with the ethnic and cultural characteristics required for military success. It has always proved an obstacle for many writers interested in military history. A good number have either failed to overcome this hurdle, or failed perhaps even to see the need. The overwhelming majority of non-academic published military history in Australia, therefore, falls within a well-established reverential tradition. The ANZAC legend, in its need, so this ANZAC refers to Australian soldiers, in its need to link the ideas of national character to past military exploits, sometimes requires interpretations of events that diverge from what might be expected be called objective or detached historical inquiry. Zombies are born in such points of divergence. Of course, there is also more prosaic explanations. As many of the chapters of this book will attest, zombies have regularly sprung out of simple need to find a way to cope with the human horror of war. Zombie myths can, have, and so long as they exist, will continue to make the tragedy of the waste of war a little bit more palatable. At this juncture, allow the authors to make two specific points clear. First, our confrontation with zombies of Australian military history addressed in this book are by no means a denigration, disapproval, or censure of the efforts and self-sacrifice of those servicemen and women who participated in the events in question. In this regard, critique is not criticism. Isn't that beautiful? It's a critique and it's not criticism. Okay. Second, neither is it our overt attention to undermine or destroy the positive social messages or cultural capital contained at the heart of the fables and legends associated with many of the events under discussion. We do not seek to myth-bust for its own sake. Rather, we seek to present the difference between myth and historical fact. The truth does count. Let us remember that in either a physical or mental form, the idea of a zombie still represents a loss of cognition, consciousness, and free will. Zombiehood removes inquisitiveness, insight, and intellectual reflection. Zombies are the embodiment of conformity. They move and decay to a group cadence. These characteristics are the enemies of free, rational thought and reason. It is against these tendencies that most teachers, academics, and historians thrive. This is why this book has to be written. Before turning the pages, the reader should note that there are only two proven methods to destroy zombies. Isn't that beautiful? What a beautiful... Before turning the pages, just wait. Chew on this. It's almost Shakespearean. Can I say this is... The quality of this writing is up there with quality. Chew on this. Chew on this point. Yeah, we're at the play. There's option A or option B. What are we going to do? It's brilliant. One is to assault them so vigorously to cause so much trauma that the beast eventually falls. Okay, we're not going to do that. The other is to show the creature a sense of his or her own predicament. The mere taste of either salt or meat, for example, is usually enough to recover a zombie's past personality, encourage awareness of itself, and returning the beast to the grave. Depending on the zombie myth in question, both methods are used by the authors of this book. Some myths invariably require sustained infliction of irrecoverable damage. Others are put to rest by more gentle exposure to reality. Either way, for some readers, the chapters will follow will not make for comfortable reading. You can bet your bottom dollar this is the most agonizing read. Some things I didn't know, and it's been agonizing to read a little bit into it. Contented truths may be challenged. Calm preconceptions might be disturbed. Safe stereotypes may be swept away. In the end, however, a rattled reality is surely preferable to a zombie-like state. Okay, that ends the introduction. Thanks for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.